Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network. And this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger here in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana on Moon's Day. Yeah, coming up on 4th of July, which I dread, as I dread all holidays. It's the 30th of June yet, not July yet. The numbnuts and the morons are already exploding firecrackers and stuff and stores all over the place selling this stuff, which we're putting millions and millions of dollars more into the Chinese bank accounts every year at 4th of July. I mean, not even including all the other money we're putting in their bank account. But there's something that, you know, all the holidays sort of turned me off. But anyhow, the 4th of July, the older I get and the more I know about things, the more nauseated I get. I get almost physically nauseated thinking about it, hearing about it, reading about it, seeing it on TV, and all this nonsense, all this crap that's put out on 4th of July. Unbelievable. You know, another thing I was thinking about the other day, and that's this. Really, we're the first, should be, the first real racist that's existed since European tribalism ended. Because once nations were formed, it didn't take long for people of other races to be brought in as slaves or whatever. Even though they weren't a majority, they were there. And white people began to accept them, mostly for economic reasons. And so, it's like the South. They weren't really racist, because a racist, a true racist, is a separatist. He's a racial tribalist. He wants complete, utter separation. He doesn't want to have the nice ones working for him. He don't want the slaves. He don't need a plantation and all that stuff. No. A true racist, no matter what race he's from or she's from, wants absolute total separation. Now, name me any period in our history where we've had that. We started right out with capitalist plantation slavery. So we didn't even get started right in North America. Actually, they were still more on the ball in Europe at that time than we are here. They weren't establishing plantations in England. They had white slavery. I mean, they had slavery, a different form, you know, white worker slavery in the Industrial Revolution. But as far as non-whites, especially in the northern or central European countries, there wasn't much. So the United States really led the way in catapulting race mixing to its zenith, our founding fathers. It didn't make any difference whether you hated all the slaves in your plantation. The fact that they were there, you betrayed your race. And since you betrayed your race for money, that makes it even worse. Today, that's common. That's everywhere. White people betray their race every day. Every day. For profit, money, wages, and so forth. To get monetarily ahead. So, when somebody says the South was racist, no, they weren't racist at all. They weren't racist. I don't know what you'd call what they were. They were sort of a I don't know. It was sort of, it was a type of racist, capitalist, money-making operation. Like I have criticized the segregation over the years. I said, that was a system where you wanted Rastas to work for you and make you money in the daytime, but you didn't want to socialize with them after the sun went down. To me, that's total hypocrisy. You shouldn't be associating with them after the sun goes down, and you shouldn't go be associating with them making you money either. If a white man can't make money and figure out how to make a living without having Negroes around, or mestizos around, or even Chinamen around, then he deserves to fail. So I think this should be our argument when they talk about racism. Say, what do you mean racism? When were we really racist? Oh, well, that was slavery. No, that wasn't racist. That was capitalist money-making. And those big plantation owners, they had a certain affinity for the slaves, even bedded down with them all quite a bit, including allegedly Jefferson and those guys. So they had a hell of a lot more affinity for the black slaves on their plantations than they did the poor whites, who they on purpose kept the whites lower classes and the working classes down in the South, because they knew that white people would sooner or later demand reasonable living wages and unions and things like that. So they loved the fact that they had these Negro slaves. And you see, most black people or black people with have any sense know all this. They know it better than white people. I can talk to a lot of black people about what I'm talking to you about, and it's right on. They agree right down the line. That's the way it is. And they also, a lot of them will agree that that race separation is okay. I'm sure there'd still be a black race if we hadn't gone into Africa and put them on these Jewish-owned slave ships and Christian-owned slave ships, too, brought them over here. I'm sure there'd still be plenty of black people, so it's not that the blacks can argue, well, if you hadn't brought us over here, we'd be our race would be gone. Well, that's bullshit, and you know it. So anyhow, make people describe what a racist really is. A true racist, an honest racist, when they talk to you, or when you talk to them, and say, none, these other people, they may have had racial tinge to them, hypocritical type racism, but it wasn't racism in the sense that race demands separation. Anyhow, I'm going to run, I found a box of, well, Sling Blade's sending me about a dozen or so new shows, but they haven't got here yet. But I found a box of older shows that I'm not sure whether had been played and I stored them away, or he sent them and I hadn't played them. So we're going to play you one of those. I don't know from what date or anything, and of course some of this addresses and stuff may not be correct, or phone numbers like that, but Sling Blade always puts a lot of good things on the line. So emailed me the other day and asked me to send me the Dogma book on the Freemasons, which fortunately I have two. It's about 500 pages in the Morals and Dogma of Freemasonry. And believe it or not, if you'll read it, there's an Aryan religion in a way woven in and out of that book from the beginning to the end. But also, there's Jewish crap in there too. little bit of everything. Because they say right in there that the signs and papers and so forth of Freemasonry come from the Jews. I forget what page it's on, but you can read it in there. But anyhow, I'm going to I'm going to send it along to him. If you've never read that, you should go to the used bookstore and get a copy of that book written by Albert Pike when he led the Freemasons in this country. So here we go with Sling Blade.
Find that a couple members of INSF, the Illinois National Socialist Front, a couple of members were beat up by some ARA people in Chicago. Interesting. I wonder how long we're going to keep putting up with that. I mean, I never hear about white power people going out and beating people up. I mean, it happens, but it seems like we're the ones mostly taking it on the chin. But I will say this. Because you believe in the survival of the white race, you know the truth about Zog, and you know the truth about the sellout leaders, the Gentile non-Jewish leaders, the white leaders of this country, and every aspect of our society have sold us out. Because you know all these things, make no mistake about it, you are public enemy number one. And if you do any Mickey Mouse shit, you're going to do tall time in the penitentiary. So that is not to scare you away from doing anything. That should harden you and steel you, make you steel hard in a way that when you do something, you're taking it to someone's ass in a most unforgettable way. Do I condone that? Absolutely. The white race has been taking it on the chin for far too long. It's only a matter of time before people like me are silenced. I have this sneaking suspicion that I'm going to die a very ignominious death. Maybe I'm just being paranoid. I want to talk today about Thomas Sweat. Who was Thomas Sweat? Well, Thomas Sweat was a black man. Thomas Sweat lived in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. I don't know when Thomas Sweat got on the radar of law enforcement. I don't know if this was in the 90s or early 2000 decade. But Thomas Sweat was one of the most prolific serial arsonists in American history. I've seen a picture of him. He's obviously a black man, but you can tell he's got some white in the woodpile. Probably why he was showed a little bit of intelligence on getting away with some of the things that he did. Set numerous fires in the Washington, D.C. area. I believe they numbered anywhere from 40 to 50 fires. Let's talk about Thomas Sweat. As you know, he was a serial arsonist in the Washington, D.C. area, setting fires between 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, with that kind of, if you want to specialize in fire, I guess he chose the right time because most people are sleeping, so the flames can get pretty high before they're noticed. If he was to set them fires in the day or during the hours of darkness, but which still have a lot of human activity out on the streets, they wouldn't have caused as much damage. But for maximum damage, he chose the right time, between 2 and 6 in the morning. Most people are asleep, and most people won't see the flames until an extensive amount of damage has been done. He would carry gasoline and milk jugs. He would carry milk jugs with gasoline and a plastic shopping bag. Now picture that. He has an empty milk jug filled up with gasoline, but that is in a plastic bag that you would get at a grocery store or a dollar store or anything like that. So So it looks like he's coming home from the store or something. Okay, he'd have a shopping bag with a sock tied to the handle of the jug. He would set the sock on fire. It acted, I mean, this is a very crude instrument he used. It acted as a wick. Now, if he would have poured the flames, he set fire to a number of front porches and back porches of houses. Never any inside jobs, just mainly outside, front porches and back porches of residential areas. If you would have just poured the gasoline on the porch and then just tossed a match, well, when the gasoline would flame up, he would run away. And there's a good chance that he could be seen doing that. So he tied a sock, a regular athletic sock, you know, one of them long ones, the ones that come up to your knee. You know, I guess you can still buy those. Tied that to the handle, and he set the sock on fire, giving him plenty enough time to get away before the sock that was on fire would melt the plastic, therefore igniting the gas in the milk jug. And he chose the right kind of container, too, because the plastic on milk jugs tend to be very thin. If he would have chosen a milk jug, or not a milk jug, but a plastic container that holds oil or some other kind of petroleum product, those are usually made of a thicker plastic. So he may not have been as successful if he were to use that. But so he would set the sock on fire, giving him time to get away. But people were on the lookout after a while. You know, police put the word out, hey, people, be on the lookout for a guy carrying a milk jug in a plastic bag during the small hours of the day, meaning anywhere from 2 to 6 in the morning. One of those socks that he used had his DNA on it. It survived the fire. They actually got skin cells from the inside of the sock because it was like, I guess all of the sock didn't burn up. But the fact that any of the socks survived the fire is really a freak thing. Now, if Thomas Sweat would have used a sock that he just got out of the laundry, making sure to wash his socks inside out, is, you know, instead of just throwing the socks in the washing machine, he'd turn them inside out and wash them, he probably wouldn't have got caught. Or just used a strip of bed sheet or something like that. Interesting. I like to look at crime stories and think, how would I do it different? Because I base this show about where Thomas Sweat went wrong simply for the fact that when we come under foreign occupation, which I believe it is a good possibility, especially Asiatic occupation, or maybe UN occupation, which will be a hodgepodge military force of whites, blacks, browns, yellows. I'm going to tell you right now, if America's ever occupied by a UN force that has white soldiers with it, and we're being occupied, I will not treat those white soldiers any differently from the black, brown, and yellow. I won't. I would rather have it that they go AWOL. And if they don't, they're fair game. Remember that. Okay, so one of the socks had survived the fire and had his DNA on. So they got a DNA sample, but they still didn't know who it was. The fires were set in predominantly black neighborhoods. Now, ATF criminal profiler said, well, the man's got to be a black man. A white man would stand out in a black neighborhood. And a black man would stand out in a ritzy white neighborhood. I say ritzy white because I don't know of any working class white neighborhoods that are exclusively white. They just don't exist anymore. The system, led by the Jews, did everything they could to destroy working class white neighborhoods. I'd actually like to find an opportunity to talk to Art Jones again. I mean, I know him and Art Jones and Tom Metzger don't get along, but Art Jones knows the complete history. I mean, intricate details on how Humboldt Park and the west side of Chicago and other neighborhoods, which were exclusively white in the 60s, or in the late 50s, turned around in a matter of 10 years. In 10 years, our people were gone. And, you know, he knows names, he knows places, he knows dates, who did what, who brought about what. I mean, he knows the complete history of that stuff. To show how the Jews really destroyed white neighborhoods. And I think maybe I should go out of my way to, you know, track him down. No, I'm kind of thinking not doing that, because the guy, I can tell the guy doesn't like me. He's kind of a prima donna. I don't care if he hears this. I mean, I know him and Tom Metzger don't get along. I mean, I respect the guy. I respect Art Jones. He put in a lot of years. I mean, he's not my ideological father. I have that place of honor held by someone else in the Insurgency Radio Network. But, you know, he put in his time. He's been in the racial game for 40 years. Don't really agree with a lot of his tactics, but, you know. He knows the complete history of the racial struggle in Chicago. So, that being said. Okay, they figured he's probably unmarried. Talking about Thomas Sweat here. He's probably unmarried because of the hours of the fires. Him going out at night and small hours in the morning would get his wife's attention. And someone who's married would probably find some other way to express this criminal endeavor in a different way if they were married. So he was probably unmarried, they thought. Which he was. He was not married. He also set fires only to single-family homes. Okay, so, because he set fire to only single-family homes, they knew his modus operandi. Now, if he would have varied those targets, the grocery stores, homes, apartment buildings, churches, he would have thrown law enforcement for an even greater loop. But they knew he only targeted single-family homes. Why he did this? For some reason, you know, when the guy was finally caught, I guess he's telling them that he heard voices and stuff like that. But he gave a complete confession on why he did it, but that is sealed up to the public, where the public is not allowed to know about that. Very interesting. I wonder why. Okay, police determined the make of the bag he used to transport the gas. So that narrowed down the geographic area he possibly lived. I guess one of the fires that he set he was sitting on some person's porch. And I guess he was, you know, contemplating whether he should set the fire or not. And all of a sudden his car pulls up and three to four black men get out. And they happen to live at the house that he was sitting on the porch of. They're like, yo, homie, what you doing around here, and this and that. And Thomas Sweat walked off, and he left the gas bomb behind. So the grocery bag that he carried and transported in was completely intact. So the police tracked down the manufacturer of that bag somewhere in Shanghai, China. And I guess the Chinese people let the law enforcement here know that those bags were only bought by two stores in the Washington, D.C. area. Okay. So that narrowed down the geographic area which he possibly lived, because most people operate close to home or close to work, in regardless of whatever it is. This is true for serial rapists, serial arsonists, serial killers, serial bank robbers, for a lot of them. Serial bank robbers is kind of an anomaly. They don't do that, but a lot of them have. Okay. Police with store owners worked together to identify bags so that the bag was found at the fire, they could identify what store it was. And this little microscopic chip had a number on it corresponding to the time that it walked out the door with a customer with some merchandise in the bag. Okay. Police worked with store owners. And they had a bunch of bags rigged with this little microscopic metal chip that would survive any type of fire. I guess it was made of a special alloy. So when that chip was found at one of the fires next to the where the origin of the fire was, because, you know, I mean, the milk jug would melt down, but most of it would remain, but it would be a hard, charred little piece of plastic. So they'd sift through that area, and they find this little chip with a number on it. They knew what store it came from, and they knew about what time that it walked out the door with the customer with merchandise in the bag. And they could look at the videotapes and say, okay, it was probably this guy. So keep that in mind, I guess. This is where I really going over this to teach you one thing, to pay attention to detail. All right. They would have video of the customer because that would correspond to the chip. Okay, police found a Marine uniform in a trash dumpster across the street from one of the fires. So they take this Marine uniform and they swab the waistband of the pants and found skin cells. The skin cells happened to be, the DNA of the skin cells of the Marine uniform pants, the trousers, happened to match the DNA that was found on the sock. Okay, so they know that this guy was either in the Marines, knew someone that was in the Marines, or somehow was had something to do with the Marines. So they're finding out more and more about this guy. Thomas Sweat would have been better off getting rid of that Marine uniform, far from home, far from work. Throwing it away would have been fine, but as long as it was done on the other side of town or two towns away, he should have paid attention to detail. Maybe he wasn't an ex-Marine. A Marine would know better. Okay. Found uniform and dumpster. Skin cells and waistband matched the DNA of the sock that survived one of the fires. Okay. Also, three men came home. Okay, I think I talked about three men came home late one night and found a man sitting on their porch set. The arsonist was chased off, but his gas bomb was left behind. And one of Thomas Sweat's head hairs. Okay, that's right. One of his head hairs was in the bag. So that matched DNA of the sock and matched DNA of the Marine uniform. The composite, because the men that chased off Thomas Sweat before he had a chance to set that fire, they gave the police a composite. And when Thomas Sweat became a person of interest, he matched the composite, meaning the drawn picture of a supposed suspect. You guys know what a composite is. Okay. Composite matched after he got on the radar, also the type of bag he was using. Thomas Sweat should be more careful about his bag. No. Okay, the Marines were also investigating a string of fires. There were some fires that were set on a Marine base that's within the proximate area there. One of the things that cops do, all law enforcement does this, irregardless whether it's the alphabet soup, Praetorian, ZAW type of law enforcement, or you're just your regular flatfoot investigator. They all, if there's a crime that goes down, they look at all surveillance cameras of banks, McDonald's, anything, street cam, anything that's in that area to see if they can get a make and model of the car, to see if they know what the guy looks like. They look for a particular jacket. In one series of bank robberies that happened, this is also on the East Coast, and in fact, these bank robbers were black, they identified one of the guys simply because of the wear patterns of his jeans. They found these jeans in his closet, and because this his image was caught on video surveillance in the bank, they compared the image of these pants that was on video to these pants they found in this guy's closet after he got on the police radar, and they matched. All the wear patterns lined up. Something else to think about. That's why you need to destroy all your Ghost Wolf clothing. Okay, Thomas Sweat's license plate was caught on a CCTV video surveillance in the area of one of the Marine fires. So he was already on the Marine Naval Investigative Services radar. And now when the ATF said, hey, found out that the Marines were also experiencing some fires, so they kind of shared notes and said, hey, well, we're looking at this guy named Thomas Sweat. Okay? That's the Navy Investigative Services. Navy Criminal Investigative Services, NCIS, that's right. As you guys know, the Marines are part of the Navy. when my friend would get a check from the Marines, it's the Department of the Navy. I don't know if you guys knew that or not. Okay, while under surveillance, the police discovered that he lived close to one of the stores that used his type of bag. All right. Okay. Now, what can we learn about Thomas Sweat? That's pretty much the end of my notes. First of all, Thomas Sweat operated close to home and close to work. Okay, he violated one of those two things. In this case, he operated close to home. Especially the initial fires. As he got more bold, then his area of operation would spread out wider. That is characteristic of everybody. When people embark on a criminal pathway in life, it seems that they always start off close to home because they're already nervous about doing the job. So they want to be in an area that they feel comfortable. I'm telling you, the reason why I bring this up because when we come under occupation, in order to stay off of the radar of Zog, who will definitely be working in with foreign occupiers, Zog will not fight them, they will be working with foreign occupiers, or when we become a full-blown police state, we already are, but I'm talking about an ostensible police state, where they're not to hide the fact anymore. The reason why I bring this up is because you cannot violate that. Even if you feel uncomfortable in an area you're not familiar with, get familiar with it. As long as it's far from home, far from work, and you wear nondescript, uncharacteristic clothing, clothing that you destroy when you're done. Now, you're going to go through a lot of clothing, I guess, but that depends. I mean, you got to make the call on that. I mean, if you're going to embark in arson, which is a low-tech form of guerrilla warfare, I mean, arson's been used by the leftist insurgents in Brazil in the 60s. It's been used by Castro and his guys. It's been used by the Viet Cong. It's been used by the Muslims in Algeria to fight the French occupation. The French, I think, were a little bit too merciful. I think the French should have liquidated the entire Muslim population and populated that area with French people. Because if you look at the death, the imminent death of the Republic of France, you'll see that their Muslim immigration started from Algeria, Tunisia, and Algiers, you know, which is in Algeria or whatever. But from that part of the world, Morocco, that's where their immigration, Muslim immigration came from. Then it came from Pakistan and other places like that. French should have nipped that shit in the bud. They're too merciful. But if Thomas Sweat would have operated far from home and far from work, he would have been fine. Also, discarding personal items close to one of the fires, you just don't do that. You don't spit out a piece of gum in an area of operation. You don't discard a wadded up piece of paper. Even if you throw it in a mud puddle and some weeds, you just don't know. It can be discovered. And if you, for some reason, become a person of interest, well, they have this discarded piece of paper with your handwriting on it and possibly a fingerprint. You try not to even spit on the ground. Because if they use some kind of track dogs, that dog will stop at your spit. It will lead right to it. Because they say that when the dog tracks your scent, he follows your breath. There's an enzyme, I guess, that we release out of our bodies through our mouth when we're in stress, you know, when we're in a level of high stress. It doesn't come out through our skin, it comes out through our mouth. And that's what the dogs track. Now, a little good technique to use to cover your ass on that. Not to give you an excuse to be spitting on the job. You don't want to do that. Just in case you think you're going to be followed by Chinese tracking dogs, it'd be good to have a thing of pepper spray with you. Maybe discard a piece of cloth that you have in a Ziploc bag so it don't attract any fibers of your pants, your shirt, your rug at your house, whatever, and just douse it with pepper spray. And that would really fuck up a dog's track. So you can do that. Okay, so you want to operate far from home and far from work. Wear nondescript, uncharacteristic clothing. He did change bags after a while. At first, he was using a white grocery bag to transport his gas. Then he switched to black bags. But the thing is, though, they already had his time of operation narrowed down between 2 to 6. They already knew because of what was found at the scene of the arsons that he left a jug that he transported the gasoline and a grocery bag. These things don't just burn up into nothingness. I mean, you know, use these things to set a fire. Traces of them will be left behind. They'll melt, but they'll be left behind. And the ATF, they have great forensic abilities. I'm sure abilities will fall under Chinese occupying force. So, but what if Thomas Sweats would have transported his gas still using the grocery bag? He had the jug of gasoline inside the grocery bag, but the bag and the jug together were in a school book bag. He would go to his assigned target, take the bag out, maybe spread the bag out so he can get to the wick, pull the wick out of the bag. The jug is still in the bag. The jug has gasoline in it. He sets fire to the end of his wick, stays there momentarily to make sure that the fire is building up, progressing up the wick to the jug. Probably the first thing to catch will be the bag. The bag is made out of the bag is itself a petroleum product. The bag will catch, and the bag may help the wick catch fire to the plastic in the jug, and therefore melting through the wall of the jug, and the gas will spill over and fireball, flame on. But what if he were to use that school book bag, but still kept his milk jug in a shopping bag? Everything would be the same that they find at the scene, and they would think that some guy is carrying, transporting his gas in a grocery bag, just carrying it by the handles, you know. So this way, he could kind of avoid detection by having it in a school book bag. But you have to be careful if you operate in them hours of the morning, because remember, police tend to look at you more if they ride past you and you're the only one on the street. They're thinking, I mean, the first thing comes to their mind, where is this guy going at this hour of the morning? So, this is why you got to look at the terrain you're going to operate on. If you want to do a map search on Google, get to know the area, if you want to download photos of it, that's fine. Don't let no one see those photos. Don't have those photos laying around so your significant other, hey, honey, what's this? You don't want no one to see those. I mean, when you download that stuff, you want to make sure that you use a public library. You don't want that recorded on your hard drive. All right, so you thoroughly go over these downloaded photos. Maybe make a map out of a number of photos. Get to know the area. You go to that area. You check out the ground during the day. See what it looks like. Explore your routes to and from. Before you depart to that city, to that town, whether it's depending on who you are, depends on how far you have to travel. If you're well known by the system, you have to travel very far. I would recommend going way out of state. Okay? If you're not known by the system at all, well, you can maybe operate one town over. You know? So you do a thorough map reconnaissance, you go there. You already have in your mind where you're going to park your car. But it's tentative. You may need to alter that plan. Because when you get there, you were like, oh, man, the parking lot's fenced in. You know, and it closes after a certain hour. Okay? So that's where you use your street view. You use your topographical Google Earth. See what it looks like from above. And if it's got street view, if it's got that capability, use it. Get to know your area. Get to know what your target looks like as if you were standing on the street. Get to know where you're going to park. Use your topographical view to kind of plan out, tentatively plan out your routes to and from. You go there, and you nonchalantly, with casual confidence, just walk your routes. See what they look like. I suggest you do that during the daytime. Get familiar with them. Then you walk your routes, your primary route and your alternate routes to and from where you park and where your target is. Could be Chinese barracks or something like that. And see what the ground looks like at night. Okay? There may be some shadows that you can exploit. There may be a cut with a bunch of bushes that you can exploit. A cut is a place between a couple of houses. Maybe there used to be a house there, but now it's prairie. That's called a cut. Well, the niggas call it a cut. I've heard it called that too, but I don't know who determined to be called that. See what kind of time I have left here. Metzger sent me these long ass tapes. The hell. All right. So that's what you do. Okay. You operate far from home and far from work. You wear nondescript, uncharacteristic clothing. And you take the extra precaution of either finding a surreptitious way of getting out to that town, to that city. If you can take transportation to get there that can't be traced back to you, more the better. If you take your personal car there, I recommend you do not have personalized plates. You do not have bumper stickers that say, you can have my gun, you pry for my dead cold fingers. No, don't put shit like that on your car. In fact, if you want, you can buy sheets of magnet. You can buy sheets of magnet at a hobby store. And you go out and you get some bumper stickers that say something like, don't shoot, I want to grow up. You know, I know you've seen that bumper sticker before. It's got the little black kid on it. You know, it's an anti-gun bumper sticker. Get one of those stickers, put it on a piece of magnet, cut the magnet around the sticker, and then place that on the back of your car. This way, when you get in the vicinity of that town, you can slap that on the back of your car. And if you do get seen by any, and also you're going to doctor up your plate somehow, either get totally different plates or maybe alter your numbers by using tape. You know, you can turn a 9 into an 8 by using a piece of tape. You know, if you are pulled over, you can play, hey man, what the fuck? Cursed again. You mean, hey man, what the hell? I don't know how that got on here. When someone's messing with me, you know, you can do that. So, I know this sounds like overanalysis, but trust me, from personal experience, trust me, you will be fine. You set a goal. You visualize success at that goal. You self-talk days, weeks, months up into the event. I can do this. I am an Aryan warrior. I am a successful Aryan insurgent fighting the occupying force that wants to destroy my race. And hours before the op, during the op, and even after the op, you use deep meditative breathing. If for whatever reason, whatever fluke reason, they come to interview you and you give them the 5 words, you make sure you use deep meditative breathing. It's called arousal control. Because they can gauge you now. They have technology now that they can look at you from afar. They don't have to hook you up to a lie detector no more. They got a gun. It's like a radar gun in a way. And they can point in your direction from a concealed position that you can't even see them. And they can look at you. They can explore your heat plume. They can actually get your pulse on it and something else, determine if you're lying or not. But you're not going to be lying because you'll be given the 5 words. But you, during that time, you use deep meditative breathing. Don't let your chest rise real high and fall real low because an investigator will see that. Use deep, slow, shallow breathing. I know deep and shallow sound like a contradictory thing there, but just deep, slow breathing. When I say shallow, don't use real drastic movements with your chest when you're given the 5 words. Okay, but if Thomas Sweat would have used a book bag, you know, because his he set a number of fires by using a grocery bag with the milk jug. So, you know, he's when you do something like that, you are creating what they call a signature. Okay? There's a 7-Eleven by me that I've walked behind that 7-Eleven to take a piss before a number of times. I just don't like public bathrooms. You know, you can kind of get ambushed in a public bathroom. So when I'm outside, I mean, I avoid public bathrooms at all costs, pretty much. If I get in a jam, I don't want to be cornered. But anyways, but I've noticed that this 7-Eleven behind me has like at least 150 discarded plastic bottles behind this thing. A lot of them still have the lids on them. You can use that. Make sure you don't handle it and leave your prints, but you can use that. Put some kind of accelerant in there. You don't even need a big milk jug. You know? You can use a little 7-Up bottle. 7-Up filled with gas. How about this? How about you've got a 7-Up bottle with gas in it in a lunchbox with a banana and a half-eaten sandwich? Or better yet, not 7-Up. How about a Mountain Dew? Because gas has like a yellowish to it. So does Mountain Dew. And here's what you do. In the small hours of the night, you surreptitiously sneak into the Chinese commandant's office at night. Using your glass cutter, you cut a little triangular section out above the locking mechanism. You put some duct tape around the area that you cut and maybe a piece over it. You take a little rag and then you push in on it without shattering the window. That's why you put tape outside the cutted area, you know, to keep glass from shattering. Pop that little section out, peel it back, take off all the tape that you put on there. Bunch it up together, put it in your bag. Don't leave it at the scene. You want to leave as little forensic evidence for the Chinese investigative services as possible. Okay. So you use a surreptitious entry like that. You know, you got this triangular hole in the window. Reach in, unlock the window. Stealthily, slowly get in there. When you get inside, you got one of them little flashlights. And by the way, on the other side of this tape, I think I talked about the bug out bag, the apocalypse bag, and the ghost wolf bag. I want to change the thing about the flash. You don't want one of them big magnum flashlights. For one, it's going to be heavier in your pack. You want a littler magnum flashlight. Kind of you can fit in your hand, but you can still use it as a blunt weapon, like a yawara. You martial artists know what I'm talking about when I say yawara. You can use a little flashlight like that. In fact, Palin Press has a training defense video how you can use a little pocket flashlight as a defense weapon. Be good to check out. But plus, you can have that flashlight and maybe a couple packages of extra batteries, which would still be lighter than one of them 2-foot magnum flashlights that take like 6, 8 D-cell batteries or whatever the big batteries are called. Okay? So you get inside surreptitiously, and you scan up at the corners real quick with a beam of light to see if there are any sensors. You may be able to see them even without the light being on because they'll have red. If for whatever reason, if you see a green light that changed to red or a red light that changed to green, I would flash it with a flashlight to see if it's a sensor. If that color changes on you, that means you've been detected. Okay, but if not, here's what you do in the Chinese commandant's office. With a little Mountain Dew bottle of gas. You go to one of the corners on the other side of where the open window is because you want to feed the fire from the other side of the house, from the other side of the room. This way the fire will burn towards the opening, causing and maximizing damage. That is guerrilla warfare. That is a type of guerrilla warfare we will use against our occupying cheeky army. Okay? So you get in a far corner. You want to take the cap off of your gasoline. You can take that cap, set it in the corner. Pour the gasoline out, place the bottle in the corner with it. You want to burn the bottle and the cap up with the building. You don't want to take none of that stuff with you. You take a long piece of cloth out and you light it at the one end. Make sure it's catching, make sure it's working its way towards the gas. But then again, it may catch anyways because of the fumes. But because you're carrying a small container of gas that you will use against a foreign occupying army, even if it was to ignite right then and there, it's because of a small fire, you'll stand a pretty good chance of still getting away. Okay? If you use a big milk jug, that's going to be a bigger flare-up. And, chances are it may be seen. But if you set small fires using a small container of accelerants and at the small hours of the morning, something that maybe you can even carry in your pocket, that'll be good too. There was an arsonist one time who had a little bottle with him, like maybe a bottle that you could fit in your hand. And he would go, he'd go in these buildings, the apartment buildings, he'd look down the hallway that way, look the other way. He basically flipped this nozzle up, I forgot what this bottle was. I think it was like a hair product that you used to squeeze it into your hair while you're working in some other chemical. I think it was like some kind of hair dye thing. When you flip the nozzle down, it won't leak. When you flip it up, you can basically squeeze the bottle and squirt it. And what this guy would do, he would basically flip that nozzle up and just squirt one streak of gas on the wall and then light it with the lighter. So it starts out as just like this flaming streak of gas. Very small fire, but it gives them a chance to get away. Within 15 minutes, the whole freaking hallway's lit up. Okay? But he wasn't smart enough, though. He didn't remember to open up the window at the far end of the hallway. Okay, a fire will smother if there's no source of oxygen. But Thomas Sweat didn't have that problem. Okay, so he could have transported those things in a book bag. He set fires only to single-family homes. Narrowing down, when you set a signature like that, you're making it easier for the Chinese investigative services. You make it easier for them. If you were to copy Thomas Sweat, you would mix it up. You would go churches that were serving the Chinese occupying army. You would do mosques that were serving the Chinese occupying army. Synagogues. Any house of worship that was giving aid to the enemy. Public buildings, apartment building hallways, vestibules and apartment buildings. Empty or vacant apartments that are surrounded by tenants who support the Chinese occupying army. I mean, mix it up. There's all kind of targets out there once we become under occupation. Some say we're under occupation now. And you don't want to use any kind of wick like the way he did that has your DNA on it. Okay? If you want to use a sock, make sure it's either a clean sock or a sock that's never been worn. You don't want to discard things close to where your sources are going to be. You want to do it this way. You want to make sure that you're not conflicted about doing something, and therefore you're seen leaving the thing, leaving behind your little bomb or whatever. That's why it's maybe good to carry like a small lighter on you and a little vial of gasoline that you can flip up a nozzle and just do a quick streak on the wall and then set fire to it with your lighter. Give you plenty of time to get away. Okay. Also, he used bags from that one store. Okay. You want to use all different types of bags from Walmart, Target, Trader Joe's, whatever. Don't forget, there are a lot of discarded plastic bags on the street in recycle bins. You see recycle bins, in residential areas are pretty ubiquitous now. If you need a plastic container, know what night a certain area puts their garbage out at night. Or if you live in an area like me that has alleys, you can just go up and down an alley looking for a good plastic container. So you should never use a plastic container of something you personally bought. You don't want to use a Sunny D orange juice container where there will be witnesses, maybe your kids or your wife or your friends or your neighbor who saw you with a Sunny D container, maybe drinking from it. Make sure it's a container Okay, that cannot be traced back to you. They are all over the place. They're behind buildings. They're in industrial areas. They're in industrial parks, corporate parks. You know, it's discarded trash everywhere like that. Plus, it may have someone else's DNA on it. So, remember that. Okay, I have some notes here from, not Apocalypse Man, but another two-hour documentary on the History Channel a couple weeks ago called After the Apocalypse. Some notes there said, it only took 4 days for New Orleans to descend into anarchy and massive chaos after Katrina. 4 days. Okay? You have an area that's overloaded with human scum. It don't take long for them to descend into chaos because that is their natural self. You don't want to be around any place like that if the crap hits the fan. If you do, make sure you've got plenty of ammo. Okay, freeways will be impassable because of the mass exodus out of the city. You may need to find whatever kind of wheels you can. Maybe who of you guys to know how to hotwire cars? I don't know how to do it personally, but maybe behoove you to do that. Okay, so expect, if you wait late to vacate a major city, you may do so to your peril because freeways will be impassable. And because you cannot get past, they could become bottlenecks. And then you got black and Hispanic thugs walking up the freeway, you know, with armed, they're armed to the teeth and they're, you know, you can't back out or you can't go forward and you're just a sitting duck there. I mean, you don't want to be in a situation like that. Never allow yourself to get boxed in with a vehicle or when you're on foot. Always be careful with choke points. Okay, goods and services will break down. The grid will shut down. The lights will go off. The water won't come on. The toilet won't flush. As more time passes, the looters will make their rounds. Gangs will form and become more and more vicious. You, white man, in a situation like that, you need to become an opportunivore. You've heard of a carnivore that only eats meat. You've heard of herbivore that only eats vegetation. You need to become an opportunivore. Also, for your bug-out bag, I would get a small can opener. I don't recommend an Army P-38. I think they bend after a while, and you know sometimes that point won't get through the can, and you just tear your fingers up. I would get a literal can opener that you twist, you know, as it makes its rounds around the lid of a can, okay? Definitely have a can opener, a manual can opener, in your Ghost Wolf bag and your Bug Out bag and your Apocalypse bag. Okay, you must pay attention to things along the way. Discarded trash may be your best friend. Improvised weapons also. Realize that you have found yourself in a world that wherever you go, it will be dangerous. If we're caught in a situation, and even though this sounds like a shitty world to be in, that may be the only thing that saves the white race, is for a situation like that to develop in America. The United States of America and Canada need to be heavily, heavily depopulated of millions of non-whites by any means necessary. And a situation like this, that the grid is shut down, there's no water, there's no toilets, there's no food at the grocery stores, that, even though it sucks, that is good. So pay attention along the way. Realize that you'll find yourself in a world that wherever you go, it will be dangerous. Even people you meet up with, they may feign friendship at first only to suck you in. So be careful. And you know, you racists out there, if you're in a situation like this, I would hide your racial views until you know the person you're meeting is for real. Okay. You need to be invisible. That means staying off the easy roads or all roads. Go cross country. Go through the woods. Use railroad tracks. Stuff like that. Industrial parks, corporate parks might be a good place to forage. Okay? Get to know where your food distribution centers are. Get to know areas where people would overlook. start looking at your area. So what area would, if this place was plagued by looters, what would they most likely overlook? Okay? So, keep in mind warehouse and distribution centers.
Again, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, there he goes. Ghost Wolf Radio, or Sling Blade. How about that? So we've got quite a number of shows here, plus the new ones that he's sending over to me. And we'll be putting more of those on because there's a tremendous amount of information on here. A lot that you need to store away in the back of your brain for a time when you may need it and your survival may depend on it. You know, I was just thinking about that when he said to pick out a place where if you wanted to hide out where you didn't think anybody'd be looking, maybe. What would be better than an automobile wrecking yard? They're all over the country. And there's all kinds of places to hold up in a wrecking yard. I know the one around here, or there's several, but the one that I'm not too far from, they've even got Winnebagos in there that are pretty much intact, that are 20, 30 feet long. And as long as you didn't have a lot of problems with whoever's running the yard, it might be good prior to any kind of so-called collapse or occupation to make friends with the automobile wrecking yard person so that when that time comes, you'd look the other way if you're going to hang out in there. I know the one that's not too far from me is right next to the Pennsylvania Railroad, so that's another plus. These are things you should judge each location or whatever you're going to do by a point system. So a wrecking yard would be good. Having a railroad track right next to it, having some potable water not too far away, and like that, so don't forget it. Incidentally, I'm going to send you out an interview from some guys who wrote a book about the total clusterfuck in the Middle East. I mean, it's unbelievable if you listen between the lines of the tremendous failure of the so-called military experts in Washington. It's absolutely unbelievable. It's no wonder they get their ass whipped. You know, on there too, there's funny, the Al-Qaeda only came out to fight in the summer. So all the rest of the year, the troops, U.S. troops and these NATO troops are sitting there sucking on their thumb or trying to find them. But there's so many places that they had to hide out, like Pakistan, it was almost the millions and billions and trillions dollars spent on this. I can just see the desert fox rolling over in his grave. I can see some of the boys, the great generals from the Civil War, not the guys with all the stars on them, but Nathan Bedford Forrest and some of those kind of guys, you know, and the guerrilla fighters in other countries looking at this thing and seeing how stupid, how totally plastic and totally politically fucked up military leadership there is. I mean, so anyhow, I'm going to send this along to you. And now remember, this is the same military that will occupy this country sooner or later. We might give it maybe 20 years at the outside, but the occupation they're pulling in other parts of the world will end up here. So that's why you have to study how they operate over there. And I noticed they also used Marine insurgency manuals written from the Nicaragua campaign back at the turn of the last century. You need to get a hold of manuals like that. Anyhow, that's it for today, 14:05, and I'll be back with you tomorrow on Tears Day. And in the meantime, think white, act white, be white, and thank you, Sling Blade. Excellent show.